Hello and welcome to edition 405 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Tom Edwards.
On the show this week, we'll be meeting writer and journalist Kanishk Tharoor, the mind behind new short story collection, Swimmer Among the Stars.
And we'll learn why cephalopods...
Kefler what, Andrew?
Cephalopods, Tom. That's creatures such as squid, cuttlefish, and octopus. There's my dinner. We'll be finding out why they're some of the smartest critters in the ocean with scuba diving philosopher Peter Godfrey-Smith, author of Other Minds.
And we'll speak with Tom Jeffries, whose new book, Signal Failure, walks the route of one of the UK's biggest and most costly new infrastructure projects, the Rail Line HS2.
Plus Monocle's Henry Rees-Sheridan will be spiralling way over budget and under-delivering with the news look ahead. And we'll play some music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
So, Andrew, an exciting show in prospect. I want to learn more about cephalopods. Does it mean head-foot? I think that's what it means.
That's very nice.
Bit of classics coming in there.
I thought it was a nightclub in Greece. Going down cephalopods tonight.
I'll give it a bet. I'll try anything once. What a week it's been. Not quite as manic as some of its immediate predecessors here at Midori, but a solid one. Solid graft this week.
One of our regular co-presenters, Robert Bound, is at home. He's been moving house, helping his dad install a kitchen. So we'll see how fat his thumbs are when he comes back. I think they may have been struck by the odd hammer blow. We've had a whole team talking about furniture and furnishing. And look at that link at Salone da Mobile. So I hope lots of people have checked in to see what happened in Milan. That was so it got rid of quite a few people from the office.
Got rid of? You mean happily sent them on their way, Andrew?
Yes. A few desks. And Matt Alagaya, who's our business editor.
He's been very busy this week, hasn't he? Big project.
He's been in the Bahamas.
Unbelievable. Who signed this off? Must have been you, Andrew.
I was, actually. I'm an idiot.
Well, from one idiot to king of idiots, it's time for Henry Rees-Sheridan.
Henry, oh Henry, love the way you jump and rock.
All right.
Henry, oh Henry, love the way he takes his hop.
But how am I doing now?
Everything is all right.
Henry Rees-Sheridan, welcome to the programme. Always good to hear from you, I lie.
Thanks very much, Tom. Appreciate it. Hi, Andrew.
Hi there.
Shall we begin?
Let's get going.
Big event next week on the 16th of April, Sunday the 16th of April. Turkey is finally holding its long-awaited referendum on introducing a presidential constitution, a draft constitution that has been debated ferociously, as I'm sure you'll be aware, is finally going to be voted upon. It will change the republic from a parliamentary one to a presidential one. And the main immediate effect will be bolstering the power of President Erdogan. Now, I think for European listeners, the kind of most recent fallout from this whole debate has been the scuffles between Germany and the Netherlands and Turkey. Germany and the Netherlands have been seeking to regulate the appeals to Turkish populations within their borders over this constitution. And Erdogan isn't happy about it at all. He's compared both countries to the historic Nazi Party. Not the wisest thing to do, probably from a diplomatic perspective. But this is a huge vote that's going to have long-lasting consequences. Keep your eye, watch your space, because whatever happens, I think it's going to be a very significant move.
Well, we have our Chris Lord in place. Obviously, he runs our Istanbul bureau, and he'll be delivering kind of news on that. I have a feeling I know how it's going to go.
It's interesting, isn't it, that if I think about kind of my general awareness of Turkey growing up to maybe 2 or 3 years ago, the main way in which it was spoken about, the kind of critical question in relation to it, was whether or not it was going to be admitted into the EU, which now just seems like a kind of an almost quaint concern. And in light of all the rocky stuff that the EU is going through at the moment, what with Brexit and the tensions within it, Turkey seems to have lost any appetite for wanting to join the bloc and seems to be turning towards other, I suppose, parts of the world when they're looking for models of leadership.
I think one thing that's quite interesting is you could see a majority delivering the executive model that Erdogan wants. And yet at the same time, that vote, even if it goes that way, could galvanise, you know, significant other parts of the population to express what has been a kind of a smouldering dissatisfaction with the way Erdogan's going. which, I mean, and it could manifest itself in any number of ways. So, yeah, a bit of a tinderbox to keep an eye on. What next?
On the 10th of April, the results of the annual National Airline Quality Rating, or AQR, are to be announced in Washington. They're described as the most comprehensive study of the performance quality of the 13 largest airlines in the US, described as a multi-factor look at the overall quality of the airlines. Now, some of the factors that they take into account here include on-time performance, denied boardings, mishandled baggage, and customer complaints. Now, I know that both of you are well-travelled, worldly men. I wonder if you might be able to recommend some alternative criteria that could be taken into account when evaluating airlines.
How warm the nuts are.
Straight at the top.
That'd be number one. Are the nuts warm? How quickly you get a G&T? That's number two. Are they nice to you?
This is what I was going to say. Just general friendliness.
Can that be quantified, Tom?
I think it can.
How many times when you sit down do you find a previous occupant's airline sock underneath the seat in front of you?
That can be quantified.
With quite a
straightforward survey.
Or something unsavoury.
I was recently on a flight back to the UK. When I got into the seat, I thought, what's that underneath there? And I picked up what looked like a sock, except it had an old apple core in it. And then I put my hand on the seat, and underneath the cushion, there was a filled out visa application for India that had been kind of like wedged down the side of the seat. So the plane had not been cleaned properly in like two runs of going on other journeys, not even to the city I'd been in.
Wow. So it's not good enough, is it, Andrew?
Well, no, but what the trouble is that planes have to be in the air, you know, like 22 to 21 hours a day to make their money. So that turnaround time is so minuscule that normally I think when you get on a plane now, you think, this is kind of filthy. Mm. And just, you know, so many of these airlines now are kind of flogging you supermarket food that you just feel that you're sat on a checkout for the whole flight. It's like, beep, beep, you're say, trying to sell you a sandwich.
But I think you can make up some of that. If they're super friendly and charming, even if they're slightly dumping on you, you can work with it. So more smiles, that'd be my thing. Smiles per hour. Oh, that'd be good.
And finally, also on the 10th of April, Sotheby's, the London-based auction house, is going to be having an annual sale of, and this is the title that they've given the sale, Important Ceramics by none other than Pablo Picasso. Now, I found this very interesting. Apparently, between 1947 and the early 1970s, Picasso began creating ceramics and indeed reinvigorating that artistic tradition. And he approached it with the idea that anyone could buy, use, and decorate their homes with them, almost Picasso as designer. So he made numbers editions of these objects, normally ranging from about 25 to 500 different editions per object. Now, what I find really interesting is that the editions were either impressions taken from the moulds worked on by Picasso or authorised replicas of his original designs. Now, I think in the modern contemporary art era, particularly since the YBA is a young British artist in the 90s, we're quite used to the idea that the artist's hand may have not been at play or directly been in contact with a given work of art that is attributed to that artist. But I think when you think of someone like Picasso, his hand, his actual contact with the art, I think is generally taken to be quite an important component of the artwork itself. So, yeah, I'm not sure if you have any thoughts on that. You know, are these ceramics devalued as works of Picasso's mind by virtue of the fact that he may not have worked directly on them? What do you think?
I don't mind it. I think that the integrity of the object is still there, even without that literal, you know, the artist's literal hand being in contact with it. Because the skill, the genius is often in the idea and in the planned execution. No, I don't know.
And I think in the world of, you know, design, you'd still buy, you know, a Hans Wegner chair that was still in production that he designed a long, long time ago. You don't expect him to be sitting in the studio still. And I think what's interesting is in the world of photography, though, you often see, you know, prints up for sale by, you know, say Cartier-Bresson, and they don't look in the scheme of things that expensive. You realise it's because it's later editions. And then you go back and see what the edition is worth where his hand did touch it, or, you know, Andre Kotesh is a photographer I really like, you see a tiny picture that he actually printed in his studios back in Hungary, God knows when, and it's worth just 50, 60, hundreds of times often more than a later print. So you do pay for that touch of hand, that feeling that they were involved. As long as you understand that, that there is a kind of a fluidity to how much the artist was involved, then I think it's okay.
In a moment, we'll be talking short stories with the writer Kanishk Tharoor.
Kanishk Tharoor is a New York-based writer and broadcaster whose work ranges from political pieces to reflections on contemporary culture. And often those cultures are in danger of soon being lost.
His latest publication is a collection of short stories, Swimmer Among the Stars. The book features tales on subjects ranging from the last speaker of a dying language to the fate of a group of icebreaker ships getting stuck in the Arctic ice. And Kanishk joins us now to discuss what's inspired some of them. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Kanishk. It's great to have you with us. Before we talk about the specifics of your short stories, I want to ask you a bit about, I guess, the art of the short story. It's always been one of my favourites. I've likened it to enjoying tapas rather than a heavy meal. I don't know, from the writer's side, is that partly what it's like? There is this possibility of exploring so many different avenues and having this real sort of quick tour around. What's the appeal for you?
I definitely think it has that experimental dimension to it. I think it allows for certain kinds of adventurous conceits that I think a novel in its length and, you know, its span, it's difficult to sustain that adventurousness that a short story allows you for. But, you know, I have to say that I'm not ideologically allied to the short story over the novel.
Are you working on a novel?
I am working on a novel right now, and it is quite a different task. Yeah, it's like making a multi-course meal, I suppose. Whereas the short story is, my book can be seen as a collection of tapas. I like that analogy. I think you'll find in the book that the short stories are quite different, often in their points of origin, in their destinations. But I do think that they, on a whole, they fit together, probably like a good meal of tapas.
And tell us, when you start out the discipline of writing a short story, many short story writers, I think, are keen to point out that it is a tough discipline, often tougher in some ways than writing the novel, because the boundaries force you to kind of be more precise, more contained in what you do and say. Did it feel like that when you were writing these pieces, that there is a kind of a need to be both limber and kind of muscled as you shape the piece?
That's true. I think a short story requires a kind of intensity, both in the reading and the writing, actually, that the novel doesn't necessarily require. At the same time, I think I found, again, as I'm writing a novel right now, that I find that when I write, I do my best thinking. And the short story in the process of the writing allows you a kind of flexibility, I think, that a novel, often because it requires a kind of scaffolding and preparation, it's actually less free in the process of writing, that is. So while, yes, I think with a short story, you have to be very concise, you have to be careful, you have to be sort of directed and often a bit more disciplined, at least in its creation, I found it more flexible.
I feel we've been very sort of literary so far. Yeah, we've had lots of good metaphors.
Good.
We've had food. We've had this sort of scaffold around the edifice of a novel. I like it. Can I ask you a bit about some of the thematics then? Because I guess people may recognise you as well from your Radio 4 piece, Museum of Lost Objects. And there's a great focus on this idea of cultural wealth, cultural destruction, the loss of heritage, I guess. Mm-hmm. And this idea about heritage, past and future, I guess, in a way, are things, some of the themes, I guess, that run through the book. Why such an interest? I mean, obviously, it's almost endlessly interesting, but why are you drawn to tales that have those sorts of themes at their heart?
It's funny, somebody said to me recently that the book, I did this a series for the BBC last year called Museum of Lost Objects, and we're actually in the process of doing season two, and it was about the destruction of cultural heritage in Iraq and Syria. And we reconstructed a series of artifacts and cultural sites that have been damaged through personal stories. And in any case, somebody, I think, tellingly said to me that you could have called your book of short stories also Museum of Lost Objects. And I think I hadn't thought about that, but I think that might be true. There is definitely in a number of the stories in the book, and not all of them, but many of them, I think, an interest in recovering or exploring moments, situations, sometimes objects, that we have either forgotten about or that gets subsumed in the sort of dominant narratives that we live in. And there is an interest in uncovering those often moments of uncanny. You know, there's a section of the book where I sort of retell a series of historical episodes that are real, but I do it in a sort of fictive way. And I've picked those incidents, for example, the curious 19th century American obsession with finding Native Americans who spoke Welsh because of the strange lines they draw, you know, through time and space, and ones that we often forget. And I've always been interested in making those kinds of connections, in finding those odd moments in the past. We often sometimes think of history as this slightly dry, stony-faced thing. But I've always found a lot of its imaginative material endlessly fascinating. And I mind it definitely in much of the fiction of this book.
We're talking about heritage there. You currently live in New York. You've lived in London. You've lived in Singapore. You have roots.
For 3 months. I lived in Singapore for 3 months. Most of it was in an incubator. But yeah. My brother and I I have a twin brother who works for The Post. He's also a writer, The Washington Post. And we were intensely premature. We were born in one of the few hospitals in Asia that could allow us to survive in Singapore at the time. And we were so underweight that we've since studied in Singapore medical textbooks under the case name of the case of Stanford and Stanley. Yes, yeah, so but my time in Singapore was only 3 months.
Well, important, even fleeting. But you have your roots, of course, in India. And it's nice to turn over the book and see that the quotes come from Hindu papers, from papers back in India. But when you've traveled the world and you're a very international person by the nature of your upbringing, but where are the roots that inform your writing most strongly? These days, if you live in New York, do you find yourself picking up the pace and the beat of that city? Or there's a bit of kind of magic realism in your writing that it feels inspired from India always. Are you inspired by both ends of that tether?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I'm Indian, not only of ancestry and heritage, but also still of citizenship. It's a country I feel very attached to. Though I live in New York and have lived in New York most of my life, I think of myself as an Indian in New York. I don't necessarily think of myself in any kind of hyphenated or diasporic way. And that's been a privilege of the way I was raised and we grew up. But, you know, it's not just the international, I suppose, lifestyle or movements. I was raised in a sort of international literary household. My mother is a professor of literature. My father's a writer himself. And we grew up surrounded by bookcases overflowing with books from all over the place. So I remember from a young age, my mother would read to us stories from the Old Testament or the Persian Book of Kings, the Shahnameh, or Russian folk tales. And there was always a fairly eclectic sense of literary belonging that I had in my household. So while I'm certainly well-read in Indian literature, I'm steeped in contemporary American literature, I think the lineage that my fiction aspires to isn't necessarily restricted to those two places. I probably, over the course of my life, have read more in translation than fiction or that's originally been written in English. As a result, you know, I potentially wear some of the influences of the Southern European writers or South American writers quite strongly in my own work. And I think my fiction aspires to that lineage as much as anywhere else.
So a broad journey rather than being anchored in one place?
I suppose so. I feel very anchored to a place like New York. I feel very close to my mother's city, Calcutta. I'm not some sort of drifting, rootless cosmopolitan. I do have a very strong sense of attachment to place, except that a sense of attachment to place isn't always to a nation, it's often to a city.
Well, that's really interesting. And if you think of, I guess, there's a lot of narratives around in the UK at the moment about identity, movement of people, and it's such a hot topic. And a lot of the discussion day to day about it is rather unpleasant. If you look to the newspapers, for example, certain newspapers. Have you noticed a shift in that? I don't know, in terms of how people perceive where somebody's from or what their culture that they're steeped in is. Has that changed, you think, in recent times? I feel a bit fearful in this country that there's some rather unpleasant narratives around that.
Well, I think two things are happening simultaneously. I think that helpless and matter-of-fact experience of belonging to multiple places is becoming if not more common, at least more recognized as legitimate as possible. And I think that's also, it's a fact of life that people can be somewhere and yet be from elsewhere, and there's no contradiction in that. You know, and that's a function of global capitalism, of the movement of people, of the movement of ideas. But at the same time, you know, both in India, in the West, in several other places, you are seeing a kind of, I suppose you can call it a response to that, and a sort of quest for authenticity or purity. And I find that troubling, because if you look at the kind of nationalism that you see in the US, it's always backward facing to that time when America was great, right? And likewise with Brexit here, you hear a lot of the invocation of a kind of superior mythic British past. And in India as well, with the Hindu nationalists, you definitely have a turn to the past and a sense that there was a more authentic India that has been traduced and needs to be recovered or revenged sometimes. I worry about that desire for purity. And in many ways, and this actually comes out, I think, in my book, because I don't think there's ever been a time that we have been pure. And a lot of my stories are interested, and when I was talking about history and those moments of uncanny and those connections, in looking at the ways our identities have been mingled and you know, to use a fashionable phrase, hybridized and mixed up for a long time. You know, it's not just a product of modernity. And so, yeah, I find the sort of projection of nationalism through time a very difficult thing and a worrisome thing, and sad that it's rearing its head again.
The first story in the book gives the name to the whole book. It's the story of the last speaker of a language and visits to her by ethnographers to record her singing. It's a story about the loss of language. It struck me almost, it could have been a journalistic piece almost, because this is a reality. But that story tells or hints at what comes in the rest of the book about a greater sense of loss. What is it you feel and fear that we are losing?
Well, so that story came out of my interest in what is a fairly serious, I mean, you can call it a problem, let's just call it an issue, of the extinction of languages around the world. We live in a moment of unprecedented language loss. Something like 50% of the world's languages are under threat from going away. And this came to my attention, actually, not because I had traveled to some far-flung corner of the world where there was some dying language, but because in New York City, which is home to about 800 languages, many of them are endangered, or languages that are no longer spoken in, say, the hill tracts of Bangladesh or Indonesia, Kenya, and so forth, but survive in diaspora in New York. And so I have a friend who works on this issue there, and he turned me on to this larger question of what does it mean for a language to die? I dramatize in the story the process of ethnographers going to some remote place and encountering a woman who's thought to be the last speaker of a language, and they try to recover from her a sense of what that language was like. And I think the work that these kinds of people do, and they're doing it all over the world, is very important. On the other hand, I suppose I was also trying to capture in the story my sort of ambivalence to the idea that you can know a culture through a language. A language, after all, is a means of communication. And it's a means, not necessarily an end in of itself. And do you freeze what... And a culture is a dynamic thing. So if you say that a language circumscribes the way people think or the way people are you then fixing what a culture is? And so in my story, I think I have the last speaker of the language wrestles with this and resists the ethnographers and is exploring, you know, how she can revivify her own sense of who she is through inventing and playing with her language. But I'm not trying to sort of beat an activist drum about saving languages. I think it's a really thorny and interesting issue. And I use fiction, which I think is often the best vehicle for this kind of thing, to explore the contours of this question.
And just a little literary footnote on that. When an idea like this comes into your mind, you're somebody who writes a newspaper column, you have a robust journalistic sense as well as a robust sense of literature. When an idea comes into your mind, do you know which fork in the road it's going to take? End up as a piece of journalism or end up as a piece that is fiction?
Yeah, no, not really. Well, actually, that's not true. I write a sort of bi-weekly column for the Hindustan Times about U.S. politics, and I don't think any of those pieces that I'm writing about healthcare policy or the immigration bans and so forth have a necessary, obvious corollary in fiction. But yeah, often the stories that are in this collection spring from things happening in the real world, things that you could find in newspapers. But you know, I think the fun of fiction And the power of fiction is taking a kind of imaginative license that obviously the writing of nonfiction doesn't allow. So, for example, there's a story in the collection, which is probably the most avowedly sci-fi leaning story there, which is about the United Nations being sort of consigned to a hotel that orbits the Earth in near-Earth orbit because the Earth itself has been ravaged by climate change and the UN can no longer govern the affairs of the planet from there. But that actually sprang from reading in the newspaper about the Libyan parliament, which had to flee the country and operate, you know, the affairs of the country from a luxury Greek car ferry in the Mediterranean, which I thought was such a tragic and, in its own way, comic image and metaphor for the state of a country. And so I took it to its logical extreme that fiction allows me and imagined the United Nations in space.
Well, people can enjoy that story and others in Swimmer Among the Stars. Kanish Tharoor, thank you so much for coming to talk to us about it.
Thank you for having me.
Andrew, I think it is high time for some music. How do you feel about it?
I'd like to sit back and listen to something nice now, please.
Great. Monocle 24 listeners may have enjoyed a chat with our Toronto bureau chief, Thomas Lewis. Well, listening to him chat, not chatting to him. I hope we've spared them that. He'd been at the Juno Music Awards, celebrating the rude health of Canadian music. And we've got some of that right now. Canadian creative powerhouses, Broken Social Scene. They released their first song in 7 long years this week. Let's check it out. This is Halfway Home.
That was Toronto's Broken Social Scene. Sounds like my life there. With Halfway Home. Sounds like my life there. We'll be learning about creatures from the deep after this. Now, as niche subjects go, the mindset of cephalopods, that's those tentacled creatures of the deep, such as cuttlefish, squid, octopus, and Tom Edwards, might not be high on your list for essential weekend listening.
But a new book from philosopher Peter Godfrey Smith hopes to change all of that. Other Minds, The Octopus and the Evolution of Intelligent Life, sees the scuba diving professor from City University of New York going deeper to understand how these animals think. And one of the reasons Peter is so particularly enamoured by them is because they're so different to humans that they might be the closest thing we have to intelligent alien life here on Earth. A little earlier, Peter spoke to our producer, Tom Hall.
The project began from coming across the animals sort of face to face. I'd always worked to some extent on questions in the philosophy of mind and also questions about evolution, but I hadn't thought about any particular animals in detail. And then about 10 years ago now, I began to do a bit more diving and snorkeling in the water, mostly around Sydney, and just began to come across these animals and found them extraordinary. The ability to change colour, the kind of engagement with human observers that they exhibit sometimes. And that was what set the whole project in motion. I began to think there was something important here.
And as you say, these animals are incredibly unique, but it's not only just our perception of them. I mean, they really are scientifically a breed apart, aren't they? That you go into detail in the book saying how that the evolutionary road where, you know, we all descended presumably from one common ancestor. Humans and octopus, for example, we parted ways some 600 million years ago. And you sort of make the point that perhaps this is the closest thing to an alien that we could find on Earth. Is that something that you think is a realistic estimation?
That's right. I think they're a kind of approximation in a way to meeting an intelligent alien. And that's because of the enormous distance in evolutionary terms between us and them. So for any two animals, yourself and your cat, or yourself and a fish, yourself and an ant, if you go back far enough, you'll get to a common ancestor of both of you. And the question is how far back you have to go. In the case of yourself and octopus, you've got to go back not just a long way, but really to the sort of early stages in the history of animal life, about 600 million years ago, as you say. And that means that they represent a sort of separate or independent experiment in the evolution of a large nervous system and complex behavior. And, you know, that fact, along with just the complexity of what they do, makes them special.
You talked about what they do, and you said that that's a sort of a marker of how to maybe try and measure the intelligence of an octopus. It's not so much maybe its character or how it interacts, but what it can actually physically get done, because you explained that many of its neurons that we would normally find in a human brain or a similar animal's brain are actually all over its body. It's all over its arms and its tentacles. Tell us a little bit about the biology of these creatures and what makes them so unique.
Sure. So as you say, they have an entirely different organization from an animal like us. So in a human or other vertebrate, roughly speaking, the controlling parts of the animal are between the eyes, in the skull, in the head, where you'd expect to find them, and the rest of the body is the controlled part. In the case of an octopus, that distinction becomes far more problematic because the nervous system is more suffused through the whole body or distributed through the whole body. And that means that, you know, thinking of an octopus as a single psychological self is not completely straightforward in the way it would be in the case of most animals. For that reason and other reasons, I think you can't just sort of look at the brain or look at the nervous system and use that information to make inferences about what they're like. It's really a matter of what they get up to, what they can do.
And other than thinking in a purely sort of clinical scientific way, I mean, obviously you're a philosopher as well as a scientist in that manner. Tell us what it is you're trying to glean from the way we interact with these creatures. I mean, are you trying to learn something that we can transpose back into our daily lives or into the way we approach problems or maybe in the way that we interact with other animals on Earth? What is your sort of end goal to exploring how these creatures work?
The end goal is not something that has to do with changing our immediate lives or experiences or behaviours in specific ways. The end goal is more just understanding what kind of thing the mind is and what kind of place it has in the physical world. So, you know, the vertebrate branch of animals is what you see is the result of one kind of evolutionary experiment in producing a mind. And the cephalopod branch is a smaller but very important independent and separate branch. So I think by looking at the two, you learn something about what minds are and what it is to be an intelligent or a thinking animal. I mean, perhaps there'll be some things that come out of that that inform directly, you know, things that we might do ourselves, but that's not the main goal. The main goal is just to understand the place of the mind in the natural world.
Yeah, and I wanted to talk maybe a little bit more abstractly about philosophy itself. And one thing that I found interesting was your accounts of scuba diving. You're a diver yourself, and I just wonder whether that environment, does it lend itself to thinking in slightly new ways about problems or about how to interact with animals? Because, I mean, you have limited time, you have limited air, you can't really talk. It's a very, I guess, quiet environment, but I guess it can be quite imposing. Does that lend itself to approaching problems of philosophy in intriguing ways, if not brand new ways?
This is something I'm still thinking about, and I don't yet know myself what I do think about it. I think that being an animal in the water is different from being an animal on land, and interactions between animals in the water are somewhat different from interactions between animals on land. That's one set of facts. It's also the case, I think, that in trying to understand how it is that a physical system can have mental states, can be an intelligent system, the particular kind of physical thing that a cell is and that an animal is an important part of that. And it's a feature of cells and animals in general that, you know, we, in a sense, land animals have brought up with them, you know, onto the earth, an aqueous or marine environment, a kind of micro, a sort of small version of the world from which they came, which is the ocean. So I think there's something to learn from the fact that life and animal life began in the oceans that can help us understand some general facts about animal life and what it is to be an intelligent system.
And one of the things that you seem to have found intriguing the most about, is it correct to call an octopus an animal? Is it technically an animal?
Sure, yes, it is correct. So you should think of animals as a big branch of the evolutionary tree, and it includes things that seem, you know, quite a bit less animal-like than an octopus. So a sponge is an animal, technically speaking.
Yeah.
And, you know, octopuses are closer to us on the tree than sponges are. You know, animals as a whole are one kind of, you can think of them as one kind of experiment in the evolution of multicellular life.
So I'll come back to my original question. One of the things that you've found intriguing about these animals is that they do have a sort of, occasionally have this human quality of seemingly curiosity not linked to simply survival. I mean, there's been experiments throughout the 20th century, one famous one in 1959, where octopuses were trained to pull a lever in order to get food. But one particular one, I think he was called Charles, was notably aggressive and nearly broke the lever and insisted on squirting water at the people doing the experiments. I mean, at the time, they attributed that to what maybe his upbringing as a creature had been. Maybe he'd been sort of trained to think this way, but in more modern times, people are coming around more to the idea that no, I mean, obviously animals have personalities and this octopus might have just been in a bit of a bad mood. Is that something that you sympathise with?
Yeah, I think personality is turning out to be a useful concept for thinking about animal behaviour. The question of which animals have personalities, I think, is quite a subtle one. If one just means individual differences, then personality would be ubiquitous. You know, one jellyfish would not be exactly the same in what it does to another jellyfish. But if you think of personality as involving a kind of psychological profile, you know, differences in ways of seeing or differences in ways of acting or remembering or responding to things, then it's non-trivial which animals have personality. And I think it has to be shown in each particular case. And in the case of octopuses, there's pretty good evidence, or at least growing evidence, that they do have personality. There are more shy, more bold individuals. There are some who are more inquisitive and some who are less so. So I don't think of that as ubiquitous in animals, but I think it's applicable to the case of cephalopods and in particular octopuses.
You mentioned earlier this, and it's illustrated in the book as well, this sort of, in a sense, a family tree of evolution, but obviously it's spread across millions, billions of years. But obviously animals like, say, chimps and apes, they are far, far more recent divides in the species tree than, say, the octopus, which was obviously so much further down the line. Why do you think humans have, for supposedly such intelligent creatures as we are, we seem to have a real problem with understanding that maybe even a creature as similar to us as an ape might have feelings or consciousness? Why is it that we do not understand that as a birth condition? It's almost something that we have to tell ourselves every day because we see animal testing, we see all these things. And is it just humans conveniently putting it out of our minds? Why is it that we do that?
I think it's partly convenience, and it's partly the history of science and the history of philosophy, you know, the ways people have thought about these creatures. So from the early modern period, from the 17th century onwards, as the sort of fully mechanistic vision of nature took hold, it was tempting to many people, so, you know, Descartes would be the best or most obvious example, to think that in general the physical world or the biological world is comprised just of machines, and that humans are the one outlier, the one special case, the one kind of system that has something extra. And part of the point of my book is to argue that we should indeed get past that kind of thinking. I think that most likely the existence of feelings, of sentience in a broad sense, this is something which is seen in a great range of animals. But it's not the message of the book that humans are just like, are no different from other animals. I think that there's a chapter about this towards the end of the book. I think that language, both as a social tool and as a tool for thinking, is an extraordinarily important part of human life. And I think it has transformed the way that humans think and behave. The message of the book is one in which we should think of a mental life as something that's probably broadly present in many animals, but nonetheless humans are not just another animal in certain psychological respects. Language has really transformed the way that we live in the world.
And I think just one of the best lessons of the book is to maybe just encourage everyone to go for a swim. because the way you describe it is in such a clear prose, and it's really lovely to get that feeling of how small you can be in the ocean and that sense of discovery. How did you get into scuba diving, and how long has that been a part of your life?
Well, first, let me say, I think that's definitely one of the messages of the book. Everyone should jump in the sea, experience the salt water, go for a swim. I do think it is a somewhat transformative experience in some ways. In my own case, I've been doing, to some extent, some scuba diving and snorkeling for much of my life. I grew up in Sydney, not far from the water. But everything did change about 10 years ago when I began to spend much more time doing this and began to realize that thinking about marine animals was, you know, not just interesting, but had importance for thinking about the nature of animal life, the nature of the mind, you know, what kind of place we have in the world.
Well, that was philosopher of science Peter Godfrey Smith there, speaking to Tom Hall a little bit earlier on. And the book is called Other Minds. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. We're going for a short walk next. We're going to end the show with a chat about transport. HS2 is the new high-speed rail line being planned to connect the backbone of the UK a little faster. It will run from London to cities such as Manchester, Birmingham and Leeds in the north of the country at over 250 miles an hour. And if things run on time, it might be ready about the year 2030.
Our final guest wanted to get an idea of where this project is going, both geographically and culturally, so he chose to walk some of the route. The resulting book is Signal Failure, and its author is Monocle's former Helsinki correspondent, Tom Jeffries, and he joins us on the line from, well, not Helsinki, but from Paris, in fact. Tom, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Thanks for being with us. I must say, this sounds like a very long way to walk, even in the good name of writing a book.
Yes, it was quite a long way to walk for me, at least. I mean, a lot of people have walked a lot further in order to write books, but as someone who's not the most prone to exercising, yes, it was quite a long way. It's the route of the train itself is 120 miles. My map reading is not the best, so it took a fair bit longer than that, winding sort of circuitously around footpaths and roads and things. So it was scheduled to take 10 days, but unfortunately, about halfway through, my knee started to hurt quite a bit, so I had to stop and then restart it again about 6 months later. So the walk was done in two portions, really.
And tell us, so the rail line has been a contentious issue here in the UK, and it quite literally and figuratively continues to rumble on. Now, many people feel that much of the English landscape will be carved up. Others say, look, we need to be a contemporary nation. We don't have any high-speed rail, unlike even our neighbours in, say, Spain. We're falling behind. From the beginning of the book, I get the impression you fall on the side that this was a rush decision and you're not completely enamoured with the whole process. Was this a little bit of a book born out the sense that you wanted to speak up against this train line?
I tried to remain sort of relatively neutral throughout. I mean, there's been a lot written, as you say, on both sides about whether or not the project is worthwhile, whether it offers good value for money, whether it will really achieve the aims that it sets out to do. And I obviously talk about those a little bit, but what I really wanted to look at was the people and the communities and the places that will be directly affected along the route. And I guess a kind of side effect of that is that by meeting those people, obviously they are the most directly affected and therefore the least likely to be in favour of the project. So yes, the book is sort of broadly negative, I suppose.
I was going to say, but I guess most of the people you meet along a rail line where people are going to lose land, perspective, you know, homes potentially, it's kind of a corridor of potential grumpiness, isn't it? I presume you were meeting lots of people, well, I know in the book you have met lots of people who are fearful of loss and what the state is doing to them. And did that begin to unpack a bigger story for you here, that, you know, actually this rail line is symbolic of many things that come from central government about how we treat our landscape, how big business wins out over small? Did you find this as a way of telling those bigger stories in a way?
Yes, I mean, absolutely. That's the kind of overall narrative, I suppose. And I think what kind of struck me was the way that meeting these different people along the route, their kind of sense of disenfranchisement, I suppose, the way that they felt, because particularly a lot of them are rural dwelling, and that they felt that decisions were being made by a kind of elite in London who were speaking on their behalf without necessarily listening to their opinions. And I guess what was kind of interesting about it is that there's been a lot of talk lately about, you know, the ruling elite not listening to the opinions of the people. But the people that I was meeting were not, you know, refugees from war-torn countries or persecuted minorities. They're retired professionals who own their own homes. You know, the system has served them relatively well throughout their lives. And yet suddenly they are the ones feeling left out, disenfranchised, unrepresented. And it kind of tapped into this larger narrative that we've seen with Brexit and with Trump about people feeling unrepresented by the kind of political mainstream, I suppose.
Tom, is there another interesting intersection here? I know a thing that you write about it quite extensively is, well, if not the natural world, nature and how people engage with that. I wonder if, do you think that, because obviously there's a sort of conservation arguments as well to do with this project. Why is that of such constant interest to you? And how did this project sit in that space? Because I guess there's a feeling maybe that, I don't know, people who write well about nature, sometimes it's quite a soft voice. Is that an issue maybe?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the interesting things about the kind of rise in nature writing over the last few years is that, on the one hand, it offers a kind of escapist literature for people who probably live in cities to read whilst on a train, on a morning commute or something. But also, I think the best of that kind of writing tends to be quite political and quite aware of the human impact on the landscape, for better or for worse. And it isn't just about writing about, I don't know, pretty trees and birds and things. It's a bit more kind of politically engaged than that. So I guess this was trying to weave those different strands together. I should emphasize that I'm not really a nature writer, and I don't actually know that much about animals, the environment. Yeah, thanks. So a lot of the book is also trying to kind of grapple with that, like how can you write about a place, how can you write about landscape and nature without actually knowing the kind of detailed scientific knowledge that a lot of the kind of more famous and respected nature writers do, and whether somebody can have a kind of genuine engagement with a place if, for example, they don't know it that well. And they don't know the history, or they don't know the kind of, you know, political decisions that have led to the landscape or the place being as it is now.
And tell me, what strikes me as interesting is you're describing here something that's a fascinating thing we all grapple with. You know, on a way, you know, the people who are in support of this rail line, they talk about an industrial Britain that can be revived. They talk about the connection of cities in the north in a very kind of visionary way that sometimes feels a little bit disconnected from reality. But the protesters, of course, talk about this version of England that is untouched and bucolic and perfection. But your book shows that it takes, first of all, a long time to get out of the city. There's all these bits around it that actually, when you get out of the city, it's not quite as you imagine. Do you think that we all living in this country are a little bit stuck with kind of dented images of what Britain is really like?
Potentially, yeah. I mean, it's funny, it certainly did take a lot longer to get out of London than I'd realised. I'd expected to be camping in a kind of nice wood on the first night, but I ended up in a sort of tiny patch of trees in Perivale as the rain kind of drenched down. I wouldn't recommend it, is all I can say. But yes, I think there's definitely a kind of opposition between a sort of, I don't know, a kind of grand economic planning for a sort of successful future on the one hand, and then this kind of slightly rose-tinted Englishness on the other hand. And I think the sort of most interesting writers in this kind of genre are able to navigate those two things. Obviously, the English landscape and countryside is not a kind of pure, permanent thing that has existed forever. It is the product of farming and politics and
I like the fact that I can hear
things.
A bird in the background as well. I think, I'm not sure if you've imported those for the day. I just want to ask you a side question. Most people, when they kind of get a book out and they, you know, they have the publicist working on it, they're concerned about a certain image of them coming across. I wondered why you approved this as a description of the author. Multiple shortcomings, an inability to understand the city he lives in, to forge a meaningful relationship with his home country's hometown, to emulate those great nature writers he admires so much, or even to put up a tent or read a map. That's a bit dismissive, isn't it?
Yeah, I hadn't really thought of that. I guess it kind of, as the book sort of develops, I definitely get the impression that I'm completely out of my depth, I think it's the kind of general feeling I get throughout doing the walk. Yeah, it's not something that I'd ever particularly planned to do. It's not something that I'd ever kind of experienced to do. And I guess what I was trying to do is that most of the writing in this area is by people who are like sort of like He-Man climbing up mountains and swinging through trees and having a great time in the environment, whereas I've never quite necessarily felt that. So I was trying to offer a slightly different voice, which is probably a bit sort of self-effacing.
Something like that. So I wanted to ask you, I referred in the introduction, of course, that you've been based in Helsinki, now in Paris, of course, you know, this city where Andrew and I are sitting very well. I wonder, do you think that the narrative around issues like this, because in the book, there is a bit of an issue of the people as against the power brokers in the big cities. There's this idea of, yeah, the bucolic idyll as against the sort of the commercial realities of the day. Are those narratives similar? You know, would the same sort of stories, would you meet the same kind of people? I don't know. If you travelled out of Helsinki or if you travelled across rural France, or do you think it would be different in some of the places that you've lived and worked?
I mean, I think in Finland, certainly there are some areas of overlap. There's definitely a kind of political and economic division between the countryside and the cities and the suburbs. I mean, in Finland, most people live in what I would potentially term suburbia, sort of post-war blocks with rail stations and quite a lot of quite reliant on roads and cars. And in a way, Finland's more extreme because the kind of countryside is mostly woodland. It's very sparsely populated. So the people who do live there often feel completely unrepresented by the decision makers in Helsinki. And there's lots of examples of that actually relating to nature. For example, the policy on wolves, those who kind of farm the land in the countryside are often feel very threatened by wolves and they feel that they should be shot and hunted. Whereas the sort of people who have never encountered a wolf in their life who live in the cities, it's very easy to sit there and go, oh, well, they're these lovely endangered animals. We should protect them and be nice to them. And obviously that is a kind of attention in Finland that I think represents this sort of discrepancy between urban and rural.
Well, Tom, thank you very much for joining us. I understand that they want to build a high-speed rail link from Beijing to Helsinki if you're looking for another walk.
Thanks very much.
But for now, Tom's book is called Signal Failure, London to Birmingham, HS2 on Foot, and it's out this week. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
There we go, Andrew. Another Monocle Weekly bites the dust, and we covered a whole gamut.
Cephalopods, good.
Telling tales to tentacles. It was all in there.
Fascinating to hear how clever and, you know, wise and genius octopus and squid are. I still, though, my favourite thing about the octopus is a drizzle of olive oil and a squirt of lemon. I think that's all we have time for, isn't it, Dave?
It is. Let's thank our producer, Tom Hall, our research team, Alexis Sogal and Anthea Longo, and our studio manager, as ever, behind the glass, Clara Barn.
The Monocle Weekly will be back next week, but for now, it's goodbye from me, Andrew Tuck.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Toodaloo.